From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, details of Chris Abele's proposed $1.3 billion budget for Milwaukee County. Later, a Milwaukee producer brings together stories of Vietnam 4 decades after the war's end.
Every story unfolds in its own natural rhythm. And when you see it developing, you have to let go because, for some reason, the story is starting to tell itself at its own pace.
The world premiere of a play that explores bullying, contrition, and forgiveness. And Milwaukee Magazine finds 56 reasons to love Milwaukee.
You know, some of them needed no explanation. We said we've lost our collective mind over Bloody Marys. And all we really needed was a photo of Sobelman's grotesque Bloody Mary with an entire fried chicken on it.
Lake Effect next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abele this week officially presented his proposed budget for the coming fiscal year to the county board. The budget amounts to $1.3 billion. It calls for increases in funding for key areas, including the Sheriff's Department and Behavioral Health Division. But it includes neither tax increases for residents nor raises for county employees. Chris Abele joins us in the studio now to go into additional detail on what the budget does and does not include. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
How stable are the county's finances at this point in time?
Well, not as stable as we'd like, but a lot more stable than they were 4 years ago. And this budget moves it further in the right direction.
Let's talk about some of the individual issues that that crop up in this budget. One of the items that jumps out at a lot of people, in fact, mm-hmm. is the increase that you are reportedly proposing for the sheriff's office to the tune of, I think, another $4 million. This is a department whose budget has been cut in previous years. Do you feel like – has it been cut too much at this point?
Well, actually, I think 2 years ago it was increased. I think, generally speaking, the budget request from the sheriff's office has always been a lot more than what we're able to do. And this year, we weren't able, for instance, to give the $30 million increase that was requested. But as I remind people, we didn't get a $30 million increase from the state, and we have 41 business lines, and they're all coming out of the same budget. So the fact that it was an increase, you know, I felt good about, and it represents the largest in the tax levy increase of all those business lines. But, you know, for 4 years, the continuing theme is we've worked very hard to do better and more with less. And for the third year in a row, we just found out that Child Support Department has again set all-time records in the history of the department for the number of people it's serving. And we have a lot of stories like that. We've added services and we have great examples of people doing more with less. And we've made increases where we can and tried to be targeted. But for the fourth year in a row, we're in a better fiscal position with this budget. We're not increasing the tax levy. And like I say, I've got a better team and we're getting better at what we're doing every year.
So if the mantra has been doing more with less, is the mm-hmm. mantra for some departments this year doing more with a little bit more?
In some cases, yes. So the way I always think about this is and this seems obvious, but I think sometimes folks in government forget this. It's not my money. It's your money. And anytime I'm going to increase the spending for anything, I want to make sure that we're going to be able to deliver more to the taxpayers who are paying for it in return. So when departments that have consistently outperformed and done well and demonstrated that they're going to have a significant return for the investment, ask for a bit more, we do that. A couple of years ago, we started this innovation fund where we said beyond your budget request, all departments, if on top of that you had some one-time infrastructure investment, something we could do for you that would help you do what you do better, what would that be? And we ended up saying yes to a lot of those requests, but that started a culture we're trying to build, which is every department head always thinking, how can we do more and better, and taking some pride in it, because we've done some pretty amazing things.
Well, so then let's go back to the sheriff's office. Mm-hmm. You said you couldn't provide the full $30 million increase that was requested, but what were some of the most important aspects that you would seek to fund with this $4 million increase that deliver that return on investment?
Well, in his case, it's sort of a different situation because as a constitutionally elected officer, he has control over his budget. We set a number. We can provide suggestions about here's how this could work, which we always do. But at the end of the day, that's up to him. And we saw that there are some places where there was some overtime. We want to help him manage that. He's got some space to add deputies in this budget, which would help him control the overtime. You know, in terms of public safety, one of the things I'm really excited about is we're adding in the district attorney's office two more staff for the witness protection unit. And the reason that's important, it sounds like this quirky thing, but the whole community is talking about the incidence of crime here, and we're trying to focus specifically on where are the needs. And one of the reasons that we sometimes can't close the cases that are the ones your listeners probably want most closed are because witnesses are afraid to testify. It's a very real thing. And if witnesses are afraid to testify, don't show up in court, we can't close a case. So the purpose, as it sounds, of this unit, witness protection, is exactly that, to protect witnesses so they can show up, tell their story, get the accountability, and we can close these cases. We also have created a violent crime task force in the DA's office, and this is to focus on non-fatal gun crimes, not entirely but mostly, with the idea being to help MPD, to help prosecutors, to help courts have cases that are closable, to get all the details. One of the issues that comes up a lot in the criminal justice system is everybody's strained for resources. Everybody's doing the best they can, but we need to focus on, okay, where are the gaps? Where are the places where we can just add a little more service and help everybody do better together? And that's what this represents, this investment. Last year, we added two staff in the DAs to help with child support. And it seems like a small thing, but it's made a huge impact. Some people may have seen there was the story on the news about the guy we arrested in L.A. driving into a country club in his Mercedes, clearly able to pay the $250,000 of child support he owned. But to me, the story isn't that. The story is that got a lot of press and a lot of visibility. And after that, a lot of the people who were behind in child support started getting in touch with our child support department, maybe because they didn't want to be on TV. The goal is about the outcome. And I think we had 340 incidents of people calling up, about $34,000 we collected of back child support because we have that capacity. So we're getting a lot of return for these very targeted investments. And that's been our approach with pretty much everything.
The other area that is often under a microscope is the Behavioral Health Division. Mm-hmm. And there's a significant increase, I think, somewhere in the $3 million range for that division. Oversight for that department is now in the hands of an independent board. How did that group play a role in shaping this budget request?
Sure. Well, as you allude to, this was the first year that that board, the new Milwaukee County Mental Health Board, approved that budget. The board is still a fairly new group. The good news is it is comprised of people who know this field, who have a lot of expertise, who know the different organizations that provide care, who know the providers, who know budgets, who know treatment, and their focus is entirely on what's the best care, not on politics or, you know, who wins or loses. So they had the budget reported out to them by the administration out there. You know, they had their process and they voted to approve the budget. We still present it to the Milwaukee County Board, but
the county board can't touch that item.
Correct.
Once it's been right. Okay.
Correct. The increase, though, is because in the past, Health and Human Services as a department would typically surplus every year and BHD would typically deficit and they'd always just do a fund transfer. This is something that had been going on for years before I got there. So we tried to address that just so we're not doing this little game every year. And I wanted to make sure we're setting the first budget for this independent group and that they had, you know, we were resourcing them as much as they needed. So again, you're going to see increased investment in community capacity there. which has continued, and a lot of our other departments increasingly are focused on how can their work help the work of other departments. That's another big theme we've continued for 4 years, departments helping each other out in collaborations.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, your budget would also see the county gaining revenue from the sale of both the O'Donnell Park parking structure and the county transit center along mm-hmm. the lakefront. There's some in the community who would like to see those properties remain in public hands rather than sold for private development. How much of the equation, in your eyes, is the dollars and cents bottom line to the county?
Well, sure. So broadly, one of the reasons for a few years I've been talking about the investments we make in the big facilities we have, whether it's O'Donnell Parking Garage, City Campus, the Transit Center, is the debt we have at the county, which, you know, while better than it was, is still very large, and it's the single biggest cause in cuts in service year after year. There are two big sources of debt. One is the legacy and pension costs. The other is borrowing from bonding that we do for capital maintenance. So every time we can take – in this case, you'll see in our budget, we're taking down City Campus. We're moving the staff that's there into a better facility. They're going to like it. That saves $500,000 a year. We demolish it. That's in the budget so development can happen. We worked with the community. But it's one less building that requires maintenance and lots of borrowing to maintain every year. Similarly, with O'Donnell Parking Garage, the idea is there's still going to be a parking garage. There's still going to be public access. It'll be better maintained. $5 million comes from the transaction, which will go specifically into parks. That's our proposal to help catch up on capital. We have less capital costs. We have one less thing to maintain and borrow for. When we sell the transit center, I mean, again, it's a big empty concrete bus barn. You probably shouldn't have – taxpayers shouldn't be paying to maintain this thing as they do in capital costs. And we're going from that to all these things on the property tax roll, creating jobs in what's being replaced and essentially turning off the debt faucets, as I like to call them. So the idea of getting out of the ownership business of buildings that are expensive to maintain means more of your money into services and less into, you know, debt and maintenance. And in terms of the parking garage, again, the amount of land that County Parks has is actually increased in the 4 years I've been here. And ironically, in no small part due to NML, because we did a transaction with them down in Franklin where we had some land that was more agrarian. They had some land that was sort of trees and old growth forests, the sort of stuff we want to protect. We did a trade. We get the stuff that's worth protecting, more of it. They get stuff that's less in our purview. And here, you know, again, it's a parking garage. It's not a park. It will still be maintained. It'll have more amenities. I think this is a win-win-win.
Well, and speaking of parks, mm-hmm. let me ask you this. You know, people are often concerned about deferred maintenance issues yeah. facing county parks. How does this budget address the infrastructure concerns in the park system, and how much of that budget depends on the potential sale of the O'Donnell Park parking structure in order to fund
sure.
that kind of work?
Well, we actually have millions in the budget, the capital budget again, for parks, for capital maintenance, but none of that depends on the sale of O'Donnell. You've probably heard me say this before. I budget for the apocalypse. The goal, though, is always, you know, unprecedented, deliver the best service we can. But I don't bank on a dime of money that's not guaranteed. So our budget assumes no revenue, you know, so I'm not assuming that that'll happen. If it does, that's $5 million on top of what's already in the capital budget for parks, $5 billion more. And actually, the proposal from parks is to take that $5 million and put it in essentially a parks capital matching fund, because John, our Dargle, our parks director, who's been great and built a lot of great relationships in the community, has had success before in other park systems he's worked with in leveraging more outside support by having a matching fund. And we love the idea.
Well, and finally, one of the issues that we have talked about in the past mm-hmm. and in past conversations with analysts such as the Public Policy Forum, we've discussed is the idea of public employee salaries and how far back salaries and benefits can be cut until you hit bone and really start to lose people. How does this budget address issues of salary equity between the public sector and the private sector?
Sure. That's a great question. So every year, one of the sort of big debates is there's the 4,000 or so employees at the county and the issue of retaining them and treating them fairly and respectfully. Then there's the million people in the county who are serving, who are paying for this government and who government exists for. And in the past, for instance, when I got there, a transit service every single year, you know, routes were cut, fares were raised. Every year I've been here, we haven't done that. In fact, this year, once again, we're not raising fares. We're actually adding almost 1 million miles of new service. Last year, we lowered paratransit fares. And that's 151,000 riders every day. So the 4,000 employees, the last couple of years we have in my budget included increases in pay, 2% and then a 3% in my proposed budget. They got dialed back by the board. But, you know, healthcare costs to us continue to go up. And when that happens, either it gets passed on to the taxpayer or services get cut. Or we say, hey, employees, you've got to, you know, pick up your share of this. So it's a balance. I will say this, though. In the past, when this issue has come up, one of the things that's been said by people who feel we should be doing more for the employees is, you know, you're going to lose all sorts of employees and people have left. Well, every year that hasn't happened. I am incredibly proud of the staff we have. I'm incredibly proud of what they're doing the last few years. And I think the community should be too when you look at just how much we've improved services. But you know, the big source of our budget isn't me per se. It's folks 90 miles west of here in Madison. And that's not just the county. That's the city. It's MPS. It's UWM. And, you know, as I said when you asked about the sheriff's budget, you know, they asked for an increase of $30 million. Well, I didn't get $30 million more from the state, and it's got to come from somewhere. So we try to be the best balance of fair and respectful and clear and transparent with our staff. We don't have furlough days. You know, we got rid of those a while ago. You know, would I like to be able to do more? I wish we were getting more shared revenue from the state, like incidentally, like we used to, not just the county, the city too. But in the meantime, I feel like the last couple of years we've been able to increase the base anyway. We've been trying to move towards performance-based pay. We're definitely doing more performance budgeting. All employees get evaluations. We do management training. Every department measures what they do. These are all things that seem basic, but we didn't used to do them, and we do now. You know, I feel good about what we're proposing, and I think the county will too.
Chris Abley, thanks so much.
Always great to be here, Mitch. Thanks.
Chris Abley is Milwaukee County Executive. You'll find full details of his proposed county budget for the coming fiscal year at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A short break now, and when we return, a Milwaukee television producer shares the story of a program premiering tonight about bridging the divide still left in Milwaukee by the Vietnam War more than four decades after its end. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. It has been 41 years since the last U.S. combat troops left Vietnam, but the effects of the prolonged conflict are still being felt. The war provoked deep divisions in the country and even within individual families. Decades later, people still work to fill those gaps. A new documentary by Milwaukee producer Mark Segrist tells the story of post-war healing, how Vietnam has changed, and how Milwaukee is linked to Vietnam today. A Bridge to Vietnam premieres this evening on Milwaukee Public Television, and Segrist explained to Lake Effect's Bonnie North what he wanted to accomplish with the film.
Post-war healing and post-war reconciliation has always fascinated me, the human nature of it, the need for it, the purpose of it. And I had a bit of an awakening in the course of developing this one. As you know, my good friend and my colleague Everett Marshburn and I have spent a lot of time with veterans in recent years, talking with veterans from different conflicts historically. In this particular sense, I had an awakening because I learned what reconciliation was about from a particular Vietnam veteran and his purpose.
In what way?
Well, Chuck Teusch is a pretty remarkable guy. He's a Army combat veteran. He's also an attorney, practicing attorney in Milwaukee, who has gone on to develop a pretty remarkable humanitarian program Children's Library International, and they have established children's libraries throughout South Asia, primarily in Vietnam, to assist in children's literacy. And it affects more than just the children of these different locations. It affects their entire family and the community, gives them hope, and prepares them for a higher level of life. And in the course of asking Chuck why he's doing this, I really began to understand where a veteran who has seen serious combat is coming from.
For the first time?
Well, I've experienced that at different levels. I've had the opportunity to speak with Pearl Harbor veterans, and they have a particular perspective. Korean veterans have a particular perspective. Those who served in Europe in World War II have a particular take. Chuck Teusch had a very interesting historical take, which really educated me as to why a soldier does what he or she does in the aftermath of a conflict.
Well, and the Vietnam conflict was so polarizing. Unlike those other conflicts that you mentioned, even though there were conscientious objectors during the Second World War, for the most part, the country was behind the military.
Yes.
When service people came home, they didn't have the same kind of, you know, they didn't come back to the same sort of divisions that the Vietnam vets came back to. And I think we tend to think of Vietnam as that tipping point for how we deal with veterans and how we deal with our role in conflicts.
Yeah.
It was a very different time.
It was. Families were torn apart.
Yeah.
Some were for the war. Some were serving the war. Some objected to the war. Some were marching in the streets. Fathers, sons were in conflict with one another.
So as you put this together and we're talking to the various veterans that make up the hour-long story that you're telling about Vietnam now and our relationship to it, what was different in terms of how these veterans looked at their experience versus, say, the Pearl Harbor veterans?
Some were torn. Some were fulfilling their service. Some had actually signed up for Vietnam and gone over. Some had an awakening during their service as things were unfolding around them, as they were watching the protests over television in Vietnam. Some of them while they were healing in hospitals and became aware of the conflict back home was changing their attitude towards the war even as they were serving on the battlefields. Others did not have that profound experience. Others were more focused on the service and getting through it and surviving and helping others survive. And that's another element that we bring out through the eyes of a Navy chaplain, Ray Stubbe, who served the Marines in Khe Sanh. He said that there were moments where the divine was obviously there, even in the darkest of moments, because he saw reaching out among the Marines that he found to be quite remarkable in terms of selfless acts of even putting themselves and individually putting themselves in harm's way for seeking to save the life of someone who was serving alongside them.
As you were putting the show together, did it change in focus as you started talking to people? Did you have an idea initially of what it was going to be and then it shifted as you started gathering these stories?
Yeah. Well, what I've learned over the years and I've had the you know, I've been blessed. I've been able to work in documentary projects now for most of the over 20 years that I've contributed to Milwaukee Public Television, and I've learned so much through the editing process and through senior editors and senior producers, and they've helped me come to realize that, yeah, you do your research, you prepare your scripts, you shoot, and when everything is ready to go into final edit, you have to let go because something magical takes place in the edit suite. And that is, and it took a while for me to learn this because every author wants to maintain control of the script. You got to let go because in the editing process, it's kind of hard to explain, but every story unfolds in its own natural rhythm. And when you see it developing, and it might be the second to third day into your edit sessions, you have to let go because for some reason, the story is starting to tell itself at its own pace. And
I would think that's what you want.
It's what you want. But at first, I didn't understand that. At first, I thought, no, that's not what I wanted. But the same as when you're working with a photographer in the field, You know, I'm not the kind of Purdue who says, well, you know, on this assignment, we need to get this and this and this and this. And I've always been this way, even when I was working in commercial newsrooms. When I go out with a photographer, he's my co-storyteller, he or she. And they go off and they grab what they're grabbing, what captures their attention, what captures their eye. And when we come back and we review the footage, I begin to appreciate and notice that they were seeing the same story I was seeing, but on a different level. We combine both of our perspectives, and that's when the story really, really starts to click.
How much did you have to leave out of this hour? I imagine you talked to lots of folks.
You know, on this particular assignment, we shot pretty lean, and there was a reason for that, because we relied to the large extent on the visuals that those have actually been in Vietnam brought to us. The people that we invited on camera, the civilians, the investors, the families, they shared their remarkable footage. Larry Dottillo, a fine arts photographer based in Milwaukee, has spent over a decade documenting Vietnam.
And he's back there now, isn't he?
He's back there now. And he was so kind in both sharing his experiences orally with us on camera and visually. And we really began to appreciate through Larry's eyes the changing face of Vietnam and the changing social status of Vietnam, the changing roles of women in Vietnam. And it was a remarkable element of the story.
The other thing that I was struck by in watching it was the really incredible connections that people here have with Vietnam, and not necessarily people who were in the war.
Right.
That there are people who've adopted Vietnamese
Jeff
children.
And Jane Brown,
right,
yes.
In Elm Grove.
Yes.
You've got Hmong people who, you know, have done this amazing thing in Sheboygan.
Do you find in the course, and you've been at this so long and you're such a marvelous storyteller, do you find that there are moments when you encounter someone in developing a project and they stop you in your tracks? Yep. Tai Vu Yang was one of those individuals, a global citizen, educated in France, a chemical engineer who changed his career to come to Sheboygan to assist his mother and father in their resettlement and their neighbors, changed his career, opened up a grocery store, grocery business. Mostly, you know, not to be profitable, but really to, in effect, become a community center for Hmong families resettling in the Wisconsin area. And he himself grew up as a very, very poor person. And in Laos, his father fought for the Hmong army and was, as you know, historically, the Hmong army was instrumental on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in saving downed American pilots and also running interference on the Ho Chi Minh Trail with regards to the migration southward of troops and of equipment during the course of the war. And Vu didn't actually serve in the war, but as a civilian, he flew some missions with his peers, with his classmates who were serving. And since his resettlement in Wisconsin has been such a humanitarian, going back to Laos and helping with the library projects, building a memorial in Sheboygan for the Hmong Army survivors and Americans who served alongside Laotian military people. But he's just one of those individuals that was touched by the war, became a humanitarian, and I followed him for a couple of days up in Sheboygan, and it was just like his rapport with his grocery customers is just remarkable. Just a gentle man who has seen so much pain in his life, and yet he is so optimistic and such a humanitarian. I hope people enjoy the story that we tell of Vu, because Vu kind of represents to me the best of all of us. And he's got a remarkable story to share, and I was delighted that he participated in our project.
Yeah, it comes across, his warmth.
Yeah,
comes
it's real.
Across.
It's
yeah.
real.
So now that this is about to air tonight, what do you hope people get from it?
You know, the Vietnam War had such a profound impact on my generation, regardless of how you felt about it, whether you were a pacifist or committed to service militarily. It was a time of LBJ, Richard Nixon, the Kennedys, Martin Luther King. So much was going on Capitol Hill, dissension in the streets, families torn apart, political debates at the dinner table. It was time to revisit it. It was 40 years ago. We've all grown up some. And what brings us together today, I think, is that we all want to make things right.
Do you think we have?
We're getting there. We're trying to provide an opportunity to see Vietnam at another level and what bridge building can lead to through greater global understanding. And what better way to tell it than people who are experiencing it firsthand?
So what did you learn?
The world is a very small place. You know, it's a very small place, and not just electronically, not just through communications. Our souls are more connected now than they were. People, especially now with ISIS and the ongoing trouble in the Middle East and other parts of the world, there's so much pain, there's so much conflict. The world's tired. We're tired. You know, there is so much potential in a humanitarian sense for us to grow globally. In a simple way, just to make it our globe a better place. And I think that, you know, again, the veterans that we talk to and the civilians that we talk to in this project just want to make it a better place. What I find in the course of chatting with veterans, and veterans are pretty remarkable people. They keep it real. And I've been hanging around that culture for quite a while, starting in Beirut in '83 when I followed the Wisconsin Marines. Those who have seen the most graphic, the most horrible violence tend to be the most compassionate and tend to be the ones who are most vocal about that's enough.
Mark Sagrist, thank you.
Thank you.
A Bridge to Vietnam airs this evening at 7:30 on Milwaukee Public Television channels 10 and 36.2. It will also air at 10:30 Sunday evening. Mark Sagrist is a freelance producer and host in Milwaukee, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. The Milwaukee Rep presents the world premiere of After All the Terrible Things I Do. We'll talk with the director and the playwright about what the play is about as Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. The It Gets Better video campaign attracted a lot of attention to the plight of LGBT teenagers and the bullying they often endure. The attention the campaign got interested playwright Ray Pamatmont, but it also got him thinking beyond its parameters. The result is the new play, After All the Terrible Things I Do, which got its world premiere this week at the Milwaukee Rep. The run continues through November 9th. Pamatmont and director May Adralis joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and Pamatmont explained how he developed the play.
As I was reading all of these things on bullying in schools or in life or, you know, people who were victims of bullying when they were young, I realized that there was very little actually written about bullies. It was always about victims. So when I started the play, I wondered what it would be like to think not about victims when, you know, writing a story about bullying. And so I think the play ended up being an exercise in empathy for me.
For bullies?
Yeah, yeah. For bullies. It ended up being me trying to understand people that I really felt that I never could. And that ended up making its way into the play with the themes of empathy and atonement.
Did you find yourself struggling to find empathy?
I did, actually. Yeah. I did for quite a while. But I ended up coming to an understanding of, you know, where certain negative feelings come from, I guess is the best way to put it, and how, you know, fear could make you act out or not act in an appropriate way in response to those negative feelings.
Is it a requirement for a playwright to like his characters?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think that if you do hate a character, you know, you probably savor hating them, or, you know, it's delicious in some way, the way that you dislike them or hate them. But I don't think you need to have any sort of love or kinship for every person that you write.
You don't have to be in love with them. Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I I like to be. Just that, but that's just me. Yeah.
Well, May, when you approach this as a director, it is a two-person play. We're not going to give too much away in the course of this conversation because we want people to have the story unfold for them when they see it. But as you're approaching something like this, where do you start?
I try not to have too much judgment in any way when I first read a script. I just want to understand what the story is, what the writer is trying to communicate, and be aware of the feelings that I have as I'm experiencing it. And that's how I usually start. And then I become mildly obsessive. And I think for this production, it was really trying to understand these two people and where they come from. And I don't know if I have to like all the characters, but I feel like I have to really understand who they are and try to find a way to connect to them, because I feel like my job is unlocking truthfulness in the actor. And oftentimes how I feel like I can do that is by relating it to something that I know or that they may know or something that we can both connect to. And so with this play, you know, it was interesting because the character of Linda is a Filipina immigrant, and her politics and her religious background and how she views family and her role in society is very similar to the women that I grew up with. And so that in some ways was very easy to understand and also be frustrated with. And
it pushed a few buttons,
yeah. But it did help me relate to her in a lot of ways. And then for Daniel, it was really about trying to understand his point of view and expand my mind and have a lot of conversations with people that may have been touched by the same experiences that he had.
How is it having the playwright here for you, May?
To me, it's a real relief. I love having Ray there to talk to and to, you know, excavate the play, because even though he's the mastermind of this play, it's the first time that we're seeing it in three dimensions with the actors. And so there are a lot of unknowns. You know, it feels like we don't know what works yet. And we know, you know, we can look at each other in the rehearsal hall and be like, that moment works, and have the understanding like this moment would work if the actor did this instead. And so it's such a blessing to me to actually have a collaborator there in the room.
Are you doing any rewriting during this, or is it pretty much set?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, there's a lot involved in new play development, and this play has had a few readings, public presentations, where you just rehearse for a few hours and then the play is read. But it is the world premiere of the play, and, you know, we have a set, we have actors, and like May was saying, things are in three dimensions, and you start to realize that sometimes an actor can do more than text can, and so you can pull some of the lines out, or you find that, you know, the actor is having trouble getting from one moment to another, and so you add some stuff in. And just in terms of this story, where the character's feelings and, you know, their emotional life is so alive and sometimes dangerous, you know, you do get to points where you're like, oh, that's maybe more vulnerable than they can be at that time, or maybe I can actually push this as far as it can go. And sometimes, again, that's the actor being able to like really hold the script up in that way. So we've actually had a lot of meticulous rewrites in the past week and a half, and I'm now actually trying to stop rewriting so that the actors can get a nice groove going.
Well, I would imagine that would come out in rehearsal. If there's something that absolutely needs to change, mm-hmm. that you can still do that. Are you here for the whole process?
Yes.
That's wonderful. So yeah, you actually get to
–
is this the first time that's happened for you where you've – no, so you've done this many times, but it's new each time, I would imagine.
It definitely is. And I, you know, I really like writing for actors. So a lot of times when I write a script, the characters are based on people that I already know, and so I can think about them in the parts and how they would get from moment to moment. This script in particular, I actually was writing for nobody. So to have the actors that we have, Mark and Sophia, who are amazing, to see them inhabit the roles, it's really helping me to solidify what the play is.
So what do you hope that people take away from this once this goes on stage in its full incarnation?
You know, I feel like a lot of our conversations these days, they're very polarized on all levels. I do think it's because it's easier to get understanding if you take like a really immovable, loud, and obvious position and just sort of let that go into the world. And it has sort of diminished the nuance of human experience. And I hope that this play will get people to have, you know, arguments, fights, conversations, to see the value in trying to actually understand the people that you oppose, people who are nothing like you, people who whose lives you could never experience, and to start making decisions, you know, as a society from that place, because I think we've been losing that a little bit.
I was going to say also, you know, empathizing with somebody who's done something that you really don't like or think you wouldn't do, or maybe it would hold up a mirror to
Absolutely.
Yourself and say, well, maybe mm-hmm. I would do that in those circumstances, which makes you uncomfortable. But I think that's what good theater does, is it kind of shifts you out of that. May, for you, working on new plays, is this a favorite thing for you as a director?
I love working on new work. It's very scary. That first preview is so scary because you don't know. There's no history in that play. You're making history in that moment. But I feel like it's important to write for the time that we're in. I feel like this play really does that. And, you know, for just the reasons that Ray outlined, which is, you know, how can we find a vocabulary even to talk to people that are very different from us? So I think it's really important that we do this now, this play, and I'm really glad that it's happening here in the Midwest. We're actually, I guess I could say this, we are setting it unofficially in Milwaukee because it's been sort of an artistic home for me, and so it's been great to have it here.
And it's in the play, when you read the first thing, that it takes place somewhere in the Midwest, not
yes.
too far from Chicago.
Yes.
So it could easily be here.
Very easily.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with this. Break a Leg. It's so exciting to have world premiere work here. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank
Thanks
you.
For having us.
After All the Terrible Things I Do is open now through November 9th at the Milwaukee Reps Stimke Studio Theater. Playwright Ray Pamatmat and director May Adrala spoke with Bonnie North. One last break, and then Milwaukee Magazine sets out to learn why we love Milwaukee. Public radio ranks at number 30. This is Like Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee Magazine has long tried to establish what makes up the best the city has to offer. The annual Best Of issue has recognized much of what could be called distinctive Milwaukeeana. But this year, the magazine's editors took a different approach. They reached out to hundreds of regular Milwaukeeans to ask them a simple question. Why do you love Milwaukee? Associate Editor Claire Hannon joins us now to share the story of the issue and how the approach changed this year.
We've done the Best of Milwaukee issue for at least 31 years. It might be more like 32 or 33. And we kind of thought it just needs a little makeover. And so we decided to reframe it as the reasons that we love Milwaukee.
And by we, this is all of us?
Well, it ended up being all of us. It did not start as all of us. We ended up taking photos of 301 Milwaukeeans, and in each photo we asked them what's their number one reason for loving the city. And there were some jokesters saying, you know, I can't think of any. one guy says, because it's close to Chicago, but most of them had awesome, very Milwaukee reasons. And so we were able to include all of those too, but also kind of compare them against our own reasons. And it was very comforting to find out that a lot of them were in line.
Well, you come up with, what is it, 56 different reasons to love Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And there are some big ones and some smaller ones. And there are also some really cool pictures that that populate this article.
Yeah, we in every Best of Milwaukee story, we had done these Hall of Fame categories. And the Hall of Fame included those best ofs or reasons that could have been in there every year. You know, there are great things in the city that have been great all, every year that we've done this. And by reframing it, we kind of allowed ourselves to include more of those things. I mean, you ask, I don't know, 4 out of 10 people say the lakefront. Well, then we should probably write about the lakefront every once in a while because it's consistently great every year. So we let ourselves include some of those things, a little more than usual. But then we also included kind of the signature Milwaukee best ofs, which are totally off the wall. We have a 26-toed cat this year. we got the Festivus poles in there. We gave a little nod to the boom in Walker's Point.
I like the write-up on Bob Uecker.
He speaks for himself, and there, we felt there was nothing we could add.
Just his name and his disembodied head.
Yes, we love a good cutout head. You know, some of them needed no explanation. We said we've lost our collective mind over Bloody Marys, and all we really needed was a photo of Sobelman's grotesque Bloody Mary with an entire fried chicken on it. So it was a fun one, but we mean them all sincerely, I think.
So let's talk about some of the ones that that maybe people, you know, obviously the lakefront, there's the reference
sure.
to the two moons.
Yes, the moon and then the Polish moon, which is the Allen Bradley clock. We had some fun with some of these lists we're on. It seems like every internet website out there puts out some silly list that kind of has nothing going for it. And a bunch of those lists lately have said that we're not a fashionable city or stylish. And so we turned that into, well, maybe we just don't care what we look like and we're just, you know, bubbling over with confidence.
I'm looking down at my unironed shirt.
Mine too.
Thinking we are the right people to talk
yep.
about that right now.
But like the dog parks, I think a lot of people love those, and I think even more people don't realize how amazing they are. Some of the really amazing lesser known museums, everyone knows the Art Museum, but Ten Chimneys is worth a visit. The Harley Museum puts on some pretty incredible exhibits. And then a couple of the people,
right? Some of the people that you you write about. I mean, they're people that are famous, the Jabari Parkers of the world.
Yeah.
But then you know somebody that we know well over here at Lake Effect, and I guess you guys know well is Kristen Settle at the Milwaukee Art Museum. But most people have no idea who she is.
No, Kristen is a behind the scenes kind of lady, and she kind of puts in motion all sorts of interesting little news bits about the art museum, but she also is like a reporter's best asset sometimes when nailing down the facts get tricky. Eddie Daniel, I don't know if people realize that Menominee Valley has its own artist in residence, and it's the photographer Eddie Daniel.
And there's a really cool picture that goes along with that.
Yeah, it's kind of an optical illusion, but the photographer said he was not like dangling over the river in a dangerous way.
We'll let people look to the magazine for the actual image there.
Yeah.
And then you write about a guy named Seth Tyler.
Uh-huh. He's an iron worker who's done just some really interesting iron pieces around town, which we mentioned a couple. Dave Mitchell, his family has been a big part of Milwaukee for a long time. But I don't think many people realize he's still carrying on kind of the leather working torch.
You write about music. There's the band Field Report that,
the
fans of local music and fans around the country are familiar with.
Yeah, they've got an album coming out in October. And I think it actually streamed on Pitchfork yesterday, the whole thing. But we love it. We can't wait.
And so what surprises me about this whole thing is at the top of the list, City Hall, is that really everybody's number one?
this list is in no particular order. City Hall just landed up there by happenstance. I think if we had to order them, the number one reason would be all the people, which is also why we wanted to give them significant face time and put as many of those faces into the issue.
So is this going to be the new face of the best of issue, or next year you go back to the way things were?
That's a really good question. We'll probably start thinking about that like next summer.
But in the meantime, you've got a good way to celebrate the reasons to love Milwaukee later this month.
Sure. We've got an awesome party on October 17th at the Mitchell Park Domes. We're going to have a light show. We're going to congratulate some of the people that are included in the issue. We've got all sorts of local beer and eats. And then Grace Weber, whose album actually comes out next week, will be singing all sorts of songs from her new album. So, awesome.
And if I'm not mistaken, the Mitchell Park Domes make it into this list as the best place to take a nap in the winter.
That is where Kurt Chandler naps in the winter. You heard it here first. Go look for him in January on a cold day.
Claire Hannon, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Claire Hannon is associate editor at Milwaukee Magazine. The magazine's Reasons to Love Milwaukee feature is the cover story in the October issue. You will find a link to it, plus details of their upcoming event at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We have our own Reasons to Love Lake Effect, and at the top of the list are the spectacular staff members that make the show possible, including Dan Harmon and Bonnie North, production assistants Audrey Nowakowski and Eleanor Peterson, and our web team of one, Michelle Maternowski, also our studio engineer, John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Coming up at 12 noon today, it's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.